He looked in Jimmy's face. Jimmy, his lips moving too slowly and too quickly at the same time, said, "We bury our sins here, Dave. We wash them clean." Dave sat down. He watched the blood leak out of him and onto his pants. It was pouring from him, and when he put his hand to his abdomen, his fingers touched a crevice that ran from one side to the other. He said, "You lied." Jimmy bent down over him. "What?"
"You lied."
"See his fucking lips moving," Val said. "He's moving his lips. I got eyes, Val." Dave felt the knowledge sweep over him then, and it was the ugliest knowledge he'd ever faced. It was mean and indifferent. It was callous, and it was merely this: I am dying. I cannot come back from this. I cannot cheat or slide away from this. I cannot beg my way out or hide behind my secrets. I cannot expect a reprieve based on sympathy. Sympathy from who? No one cares. No one cares. Except me. I care. I care a lot. And this isn't fair. I can't handle that tunnel alone. Please don't let me go there. Please wake me up. I want to wake up. I want to feel you, Celeste. I want to feel your arms. I'm not ready. He forced his eyes to focus as Val handed Jimmy something, and Jimmy lowered it to Dave's forehead. It was cool. It was a circle of cool, of kindness and relief from the burning in his body. "Wait! No. No, Jimmy. I know what that is. I can see the trigger. Don't look at me. See me. Don't do this. Please. If you get me to a hospital, I'll be all right. They'll fix me up. Oh, God, Jimmy, don't you do that with your finger. Don't you do that. I lied. Please, don't take me away from this. Please don't. I can't prepare for a bullet in my brain. No one can. No one. Please don't." Jimmy lowered the gun. "Thank you," Dave said. "Thank you. Thank you." Dave lay back and saw the shafts of light streaming across the bridge, cutting through the black of night, glowing. "Thank you, Jimmy. I'm going to be a good man now. You've taught me something. You have. And I'll tell you what that something is as soon as I've caught my breath. I'm going to be a good father. I'm going to be a good husband. I promise. I swear." Val said, "So okay. It's done." Jimmy looked down at Dave's body. The canyon he'd cut in his abdomen. The bullet hole he'd fired through his forehead. He kicked off his shoes and took off his jacket. Next, he removed the turtleneck and khakis he'd stained with Dave's blood. He shed the nylon running suit he'd worn underneath and added it to the pile beside Dave's body. He heard Val place the cinder blocks and length of chain in Huey's boat, and then Val came back with a large green trash bag. Underneath the running suit, Jimmy wore a t-shirt and jeans, and Val pulled a pair of shoes from the trash bag and tossed them to him. Jimmy slid them on and checked the t-shirt and jeans for any blood that might have leaked through. But there was none. Even the jogging suit was barely stained. He knelt by Val and stuffed his clothes into the bag. Then he took the knife and the gun to the edge of the wharf and threw them, one at a time, out into the center of the Mystic River. He could have placed them in the bag with clothes, tossed them off the boat later along with Dave's body, but for some reason, he needed to do it now, to experience the motion of his arm as it shot out into the air and the weapons spiraled, arced, plummeted, and sank with soft splashes. He knelt over the water. Dave's vomit had long since floated away, and Jimmy plunged his hands into the river, oily and polluted as it was, and washed his hands of Dave's blood. Sometimes, in his dreams, he was doing this very thing, washing himself in the Mystic, when just Ray Harris's head would pop back up, stare at him. Just Ray always said the same thing. You can't outrun a train. And Jimmy, confused, said, "No one can, Ray." Just Ray, starting to sink again, smiled. "You in particular, though." 13 years of those dreams. 13 years of Ray's head bobbing on the water. And Jimmy still didn't know what the hell he meant by that. This book is continued on Disc 12. Disc 12. Chapter 27. Who do you love? Brendan's mother had gone out to bingo by the time he got home. She left a note. "Chicken in fridge. Glad you're okay. Don't make a habit of it." Brendan checked his and Ray's room, but Ray was out too, and Brendan took a chair from the kitchen and placed it down in front of the butler's pantry. He stepped up on the chair, and it sagged to the left where one of the legs was missing a bolt. He looked at the ceiling slat and saw the smudge marks of fingers in the dust, and the air directly in front of his eyes began to swim with tiny dark specks. He pressed his right palm against the slat, lifted it slightly. He brought his hand down, wiped it on his pants, and took several breaths. There were some things you didn't want to know the answers to. Brendan had never wanted to run into his father once he was grown because he didn't want to look in his father's face and see how easy it had been to leave him. He'd never asked Katie about old boyfriends, even Bobby O'Donnell, because he didn't want to picture her lying on top of someone else, kissing him the way she kissed Brendan. Brendan knew about the truth. In most cases, it was just a matter of deciding whether you wanted to look it in the face or live with the comfort of ignorance or lies. And ignorance and lies were often underrated. Most people Brendan knew couldn't make it through the day without a saucerful of ignorance and a side of lies. But this truth had to be faced, because he'd already faced it in the holding cell, and it had sliced through him like a bullet and lodged in his stomach. And it wasn't coming out, which meant he couldn't hide from it, couldn't tell himself it wasn't there. Ignorance was not a possibility. Lying was no longer an accessible part of the equation. "Shit," Brendan said, and pushed the ceiling slat aside and reached back into the darkness, his fingers touching dust and chips of wood and more dust, but no gun. He felt around up there for another full minute, even though he knew it was gone. His father's gun, and it wasn't where it was supposed to be. It was out in the world, and it had killed Katie. He put the slat back up in place. He got a dustpan and swept up the dust that had fallen to the floor. He took the chair back to the kitchen. He felt a need to be precise in his movements. He felt it was important that he remain calm. He poured himself a glass of orange juice and placed it on the table. He sat down in the chair with a sagging leg and turned so that he was looking at the door in the center of the apartment. He took a sip of his orange juice and waited for Ray. "Look at this," Sean said, pulling the latent prints file from the box and opening it in front of Whitey. "That's the cleanest one they pulled off the door. It's small, because it's a kid's." Whitey said, "Old Lady Pryor heard two kids playing on the street just before Katie banged a car up. Playing with hockey sticks," she said. "She said she heard Katie say, 'Hi.' Maybe it wasn't Katie. A little kid's voice could sound like a woman's, and no footprints? Of course not. What do they weigh, 100 pounds? You recognize that kid's voice? Sounded a lot like Johnny O'Shea's. Whitey nodded. The other kid, not saying anything at all. Because he can't fucking speak, Sean said. Hey, Ray, Brendan said as the two boys entered the apartment. Ray nodded. Johnny O'Shea waved. They started heading back toward the bedroom. Come on in here a sec, Ray. Ray looked at Johnny. Just a second, Ray. I got something I want to ask you. Ray turned and Johnny O'Shea dropped the gym bag he'd been carrying and sat on the edge of Mrs. Harris's bed. Ray came down the short hall into the kitchen and held out his hands, looked at his brother like, what? Brendan hooked a chair with his foot and pulled it out from under the table, nodded at it. Ray's head tilted up as if he smelled something in the air, a scent he wasn't fond of. He looked at the chair. He looked at Brendan. He signed. What did I do? You tell me, Brendan said. I didn't do anything. So sit down. I don't want to. Why not? Ray shrugged. Brendan said, who do you hate, Ray? Ray looked at him like he was nuts. Come on, Brendan said. Who do you hate? Ray's sign was brief. Nobody. Brendan nodded. Okay. Who do you love? Ray gave him that face again. Brendan leaned forward, his hands on his knees. Who do you love? Ray looked down at his shoes, then up at Brendan. He raised his hand and pointed at his brother. You love me? Ray nodded, fidgeting. What about Ma? Ray shook his head. You don't love Ma? Ray signed, don't feel one way or the other. So I'm the only person you love. Ray thrust his small face out and scowled. His hands flew. Yes. Can I go now? No, Brendan said. Have a seat. Ray looked down at the chair, his face red and angry. He looked back at Johnny O'Shea. He raised his hand and extended his middle finger at Brendan, and then he turned to walk out of the kitchen. Brendan didn't even realize he'd moved until he had most of Ray's hair in his hand and was pulling him up off his feet. He pulled back with his arm, hard, as if he were pulling the cord on a rusty lawnmower, and then he opened his fingers and Ray flew backward out of his hand and over the kitchen table. He hit the wall and then dropped onto the table, brought the whole thing crashing to the floor with him. You love me, Brendan said, not even looking down at his brother. You love me so you kill my fucking girlfriend, Ray? Huh? That got Johnny O'Shea moving as Brendan had figured it would. Johnny grabbed his gym bag and bolted for the door, but Brendan was all over him. He picked the little prick up by his throat and slammed him against the door. My brother never does anything without you, O'Shea. Never. He pulled back his fist and Johnny screamed, No, Bren, don't! Brendan punched him so hard in the face he heard the nose break, and then he punched him again. When Johnny hit the floor, he curled into a ball and spit blood on the wood, and Brendan said, I'm coming back. I'm coming back, and I just might beat you to death, you piece of fucking garbage. Ray was standing on wobbly feet, his sneakers sliding on broken plates when Brendan came back in the kitchen and slapped him so hard across the face he knocked him into the sink. He grabbed his brother by the shirt, Ray looking into his face with tears streaming from his hate-filled eyes and blood smearing his mouth. And Brendan threw him to the floor and spread his arms and knelt on them. Speak, Brendan said. I know you can. Speak, you fucking freak, or I swear to God, Ray, I'll kill you. Speak, Brendan shouted and brought his fists down into Ray's ears. Speak. Say her name. Say it. Say Katie, Ray. Say Katie. Ray's eyes went foggy and dull, and he spit some blood up onto his own face. Speak, Brendan screamed. I'll fucking kill you if you don't. He grabbed his brother by the hair along his temples and pulled his head off the floor, shook it from side to side until Ray's eyes focused again, and Brendan held his head still and looked deep into those gray pupils. Saw so much love and hate in there that he wanted to rip his brother's head clean off and throw it out the window. He said it again. Speak. But this time it came out in a hoarse, strangled whisper. Speak. He heard a loud cough and looked behind him. Saw Johnny O'Shea on his feet, spitting blood down onto the floor. Ray Sr.'s gun in his hand. Sean and Whitey were coming up the stairs when they heard the racket, someone screaming in the apartment and the unmistakable snaps of flesh hitting flesh. They heard a man scream, I'll fucking kill you! And Sean had his hand on his Glock as he reached for the doorknob. Whitey said, wait! But Sean had already turned the knob and he stepped into the apartment and saw a gun pointed at his chest from 6 inches away. Hold it! Don't pull that trigger, kid! Sean looked into the bloody face of Johnny O'Shea, and what he saw there scared the shit out of him. There was nothing there. Probably never had been. He saw it in malls and in movie theater lobbies and arcades. Nothing, nothing, and more nothing looking back at you from these glassy-eyed midgets with headphones curled around their necks and fingers calloused from computer keyboards and flesh turned the color of ash. The kid wouldn't pull the trigger because he was angry or because he was scared. He'd pull the trigger because he had only a slight conception of Sean as a human being. Just like he had only conceptions about everything else, and all these conceptions ended up in the soup of the kid's brain without any emotional subtext. Sean was a 6'2" video image in front of the kid, and the gun was just a joystick. Johnny, you need to point that gun at the floor. Sean could hear Whitey's breathing from the other side of the threshold. Johnny. Johnny O'Shea said, he fucking punched me. Twice. Broke my nose. Who? Brendan. We'll arrest him for that if you want. Don't want him fucking arrested. I want him dead. Dead's a big thing, Johnny. Dead's never coming back, you know? I know, the kid said. I fucking know all about that. You gonna use that? Sean said, what? Johnny O'Shea nodded at Sean's hip. A gun. It's a Glock, right? It's a Glock, yeah. Glocks kick ass, man. I'd like to get me one of those. Is he gonna use it? Now? Yeah. You gonna draw on me? Sean smiled. No, Johnny. Johnny said, the fuck you smiling for? Draw on me. We'll see what happens. It'll be cool. He thrust the gun out, his arm straight, the muzzle maybe an inch from Sean's chest now. Sean said, I'd say you got the drop on me, partner. Know what I mean? Got the drop, Ray, Johnny called. But a fucking cop, dude. Me. Check it out. Sean said, let's not let this get out of. Saw this movie once, right? Cops chasing this black guy at a roof. Nigga threw his ass off. Cops like all that shit the whole way down. Nigga's so badass he don't care the cop got the wife and little shits at home. Nigga's that cool, man. Sean had seen this before. Back when he was in uniform and sent as crowd control on a bank robbery gone bad, the guy inside, gradually growing stronger for a 2-hour period, feeling the power of the gun in his hand and the effect it had. Sean watching him rant and rave over the monitor hooked up to the bank cameras. At the start, the guy had been terrified, but he'd gotten over that. Fell in love with that gun. And for one moment, Sean saw Lauren looking over at him from the pillow, one hand pressed to the side of her head. He saw his dream daughter, smelled her, and thought about what a shitty thing it would be to die without meeting her or seeing Lauren again. He focused on the empty face before him. He said, "You see that guy to your left, Johnny? The one in the doorway?" Johnny's eyes darted fast to his left. "Yeah?" "He doesn't want to shoot you. He doesn't." "Don't care if he does," Johnny said. But Sean could see it got to the kid, his eyes getting rabbity now, jerking up and down. "But if you shoot me, he has no choice." "Ain't afraid of dying." "I know that. Thing is, though, he won't shoot you in the head or nothing. We don't kill kids, man. But if he shoots you from where he's standing, you know where that bullet's gonna go?" Sean kept his eyes on Johnny, even though his head seemed to be magnetized to the gun in the kid's hand, wanting to look down on it, see where the trigger was, if the kid was pulling on it at all. Sean thinking, "I don't want to get shot, and I definitely don't want to get shot by a kid." He couldn't think of a more pathetic way to go. Johnny licked his lips. "It's going to go through your armpit and into your spine, man. It's going to paralyze you. It'll be like those kids on those Jimmy Fund commercials. You know the ones? Sitting in the wheelchair, all frozen up on one side, head hanging off the chair. You'll be a drooler, Johnny. People will have to hold the cup up beside your head so you can suck from the straw." Johnny made up his mind. Sean could see it as if a light had clicked off in the kid's dark brain, and Sean felt the fear seize him now, knew this kid was going to pull the trigger if only to hear the sound. "Fuck it," Johnny said, and turned toward Whitey. Sean heard his own breath pop out of his mouth in surprise, and he looked down to see that gun sweeping away from his body, as if revolving on top of a tripod. He reached out so fast it was as if someone else was controlling his arms, and closed his hand over the gun as Whitey stepped into the room. Glock pointed at the kid's chest. A sound came out of the kid's mouth, a gasp of defeated surprise, as if he'd opened a Christmas present to find a soiled gym sock inside. And Sean pushed the kid's forehead back against the wall and stripped the gun from him. Sean said, "Motherfucker," and blinked at Whitey through the sweat in his eyes. Johnny started to cry the way only a 13-year-old could, as if the whole world were sitting on his face. Sean turned him to the wall and pulled his hands behind his back, saw Brendan and Ray Harris standing in a kitchen that looked like it had been hit by a cyclone. Whitey stepped up behind Sean, put a hand on his shoulder. "How you doing?" "Kid was gonna do it," Sean said, feeling the sweat that drenched every inch of clothes, even his socks. "No, I wasn't," Johnny wailed. "I was just kidding." "Fuck you," Whitey said, and leaned his face into the kid's. "Nobody cares about your tears but your mommy, little bitch. Get used to it." Sean snapped the cuffs on Johnny O'Shea and took him by the shirt, led him into the kitchen, and dropped him in a chair. Whitey said, "Ray, you look like someone threw you from the back of a truck." Ray looked at his brother. Brendan leaned against the oven and his body was sagging so bad, Sean figured he'd fall over in a light breeze. "We know," Sean said. "What do you know?" Brendan whispered. Sean looked at the kid, sniffling in the chair, and the other kid, mute, looking up at them like he hoped they'd leave soon so he could get back to playing Doom in the back bedroom. Sean was pretty sure once he got a sign language interpreter and a social worker and questioned them that they'd say they did it because they had the gun, because they were on the street when she drove up, Maybe because Ray had never really liked her. Because it seemed like a cool idea. Because they'd never killed anyone before. Because when you had your finger curled around a trigger, you just had to pull it, or otherwise that finger would itch for weeks. "What do you know?" Brendan repeated, his voice gone hoarse and wet. Sean shrugged. He wished he had an answer for Brendan. But looking at these two kids, nothing came to mind. Nothing at all. Jimmy took a bottle with him to Gannon Street. There was an assisted living home for the elderly at the end of the street, a chunk of 1960s limestone and granite that was two stories tall and ran half a block down Hiller Court, the street that began where Gannon ended. Jimmy sat on the white front steps and looked back down Gannon. He'd heard they were kicking the old people out of here, actually. The Point having grown so popular that the owner of the building was going to sell to a guy who specialized in starter condos for young couples. The Point was gone, really. It had always been the snobby sister of the flats, but now it was like it wasn't even in the same family. Pretty soon they'd probably draw up a charter, get the name changed, carve it off the Buckingham map. Jimmy took the pint from his jacket and sipped some bourbon. Looked at the spot where they'd last seen Dave Boyle that day the men had taken him, his head looking back through the rear window, covered in shadow, gone soft with distance. "I wish it hadn't been you, Dave. I really do." He raised the pint to Katie. "Daddy got him, honey. Daddy put him down." "Talking to yourself?" Jimmy looked over and saw Sean climbing out of his car. Sean had a roadie beer in his hand, and he smiled at Jimmy's pint. "What's your excuse?" "Tough night," Jimmy said. Sean nodded. "Me too. Saw a bullet with my name on it." Jimmy slid to the side, and Sean sat down beside him. "How do you know to look for me here?" "Your wife said you might be here." "My wife?" Jimmy had never told her about his trips here. Christ, she was a real piece of work. "Yeah. Jimmy, we made a bust today." Jimmy took a long pull from the bottle, his chest fluttering. "A bust?" "Yeah. We got your daughter's killers. Got them cold." "Killers?" Jimmy said. "Plural?" Sean nodded. "Kids, actually. 13 years old. Ray Harris's son, Ray Jr., and a kid named Johnny O'Shea. They confessed half an hour ago." Jimmy felt a knife enter his brain through the ear and pushed toward the other side, a hot knife slicing away through his skull. "No question," he said. "None," Sean said. "Why? Why'd they do it? They don't even know. They were playing with a gun. They saw a car coming, and one of them laid down in the middle of the street. The car swerves, clutch kicks out, and O'Shea runs up to the car with a gun. Says he just meant to scare her. Instead, the gun went off. Katie hit him with the door, and the kids say they snapped. They chased her so she wouldn't tell anyone they had a gun." "And the beating they gave her," Jimmy said, and took another drink. "Ray Jr. had a hockey stick. He wouldn't answer any questions. He's mute, you know, just sat there. But O'Shea said that they beat her because she'd made them mad by running." He shrugged, as if the utter wastefulness of it surprised even him. "Little fucking kids," he said. "Afraid they'd get grounded or something, so they killed her." Jimmy stood. He opened his mouth to gulp some air, and his legs gave way, and he found himself right back on the step. Sean put a hand on his elbow. "Go easy, Jim. Take a few breaths. Jimmy saw Dave sitting on the ground, fingering the slice Jimmy had drawn from one end of his abdomen to the other. He heard his voice. "Look at me, Jimmy. Look at me." And Sean said, "I got a call from Celeste Boyle. She said Dave's missing. She said she went a little crazy the last few days. She said you, Jim, might know where he is." Jimmy shook his head, having trouble seeing anything out of his peripheral vision now, a tunnel seeming to have formed in front of his eyes. "No," Sean said. "Celeste says she told you that Dave killed Katie. Seems to think you believed the same thing. She got the feeling you were going to do something about it." Jimmy stared through the tunnel at a sewer grate. "You gonna send $500 a month to Celeste now, Jimmy?" Jimmy looked up and each of them saw it at the same time in the other's face. Sean could see what Jimmy had done, and Jimmy could see that knowledge appear in Sean. "You fucking did it, didn't you?" Sean said. "You killed him." Jimmy stood up, holding onto the banister. "Don't know what you're talking about." "You killed both of them. Ray Harris and Dave Boyle." "Jesus. Jimmy, I came down here thinking the whole idea was nuts. But I can see it in your face, man. You crazy, lunatic, fucking psycho piece of shit. You did it. You killed Dave. You killed Dave Boyle. Our friend, Jimmy." Jimmy snorted. "Our friend. Yeah, okay, point boy. He was your good buddy. Hung with him all the time, right?" Sean stepped into his face. "He was our friend, Jimmy. Remember?" Jimmy looked into Sean's eyes, wondered if he was going to take a swing at him. "Last time I saw Dave," he said, "was at my house last night." He pushed Sean aside and crossed the street onto Gannon. "That's the last time I saw Dave." "You're full of shit." He turned, arms wide as he looked back at Sean. "Then arrest me, you're so sure." "I'll get the evidence," Sean said. "You know I will." "You'll get shit," Jimmy said. "Thanks for busting my daughter's killers, Sean." "Really? Maybe if you'd been a little faster, though?" Jimmy shrugged and turned his back on him, started walking down Gannon Street. Sean watched him until he lost him to the darkness under a broken streetlight right in front of Sean's old house. "You did it," Sean thought. "You actually did it. You cold, cold-blooded animal. And the worst part of it is that I know how smart you are. You won't have left us anything to go on. That's not in your nature because you're a detail guy, Jimmy. You damn prick." "You took his life," Sean said aloud. "Didn't you, my man?" He tossed his beer can into the curb and walked to his car, called Lauren from his cell phone. When she answered, he said, "It's Sean." Silence. He knew now what he hadn't said that she'd needed to hear, the thing he'd refused to say in over a year. Anything, he'd told himself, "I'll say anything but that." He said it now, though. He said it seeing that kid pointing the gun at his chest, the kid reeking of nothing, and seeing, too, poor Dave, that day Sean had offered to buy him a beer. The spark of desperate hope he'd seen in Dave's face. The guy probably never believing, truly, that anyone would want to have a beer with him. And he said it because he felt it deep in his marrow, a need to say it, as much for Lauren as for himself. He said, "I'm sorry." And Lauren spoke. "For what?" "For putting it all on you," Okay. Hey, hey. You go ahead, he said. What? Hell, Sean, I'm sorry too. I didn't mean to. It's okay, he said. Really. He took a deep breath, sucking in the soiled, stale sweat stench of his cruiser. I want to see you. I want to see my daughter. And Lauren answered, how do you know she's yours? She's mine. But the blood test, she's mine, he said. I don't need a blood test. Will you come home, Lauren? Will you? Somewhere, on the silent street, he could hear the hum of a generator. Nora, she said. What? That's your daughter's name, Sean. Nora, he said, the word wet in his throat. When Jimmy got home, Annabeth was waiting up for him in the kitchen. He sat in the chair at the table across from her, and she gave him that small, secret smile he loved. The one that seemed to know him so well he'd never have to open his mouth for the rest of his life, and she'd still know what he meant to say. Jimmy took her hand and ran his thumb along hers and tried to find strength in the image of himself that he could see in her face. The baby monitor sat on the table between them. They'd used it last month when Nadine had come down with a bad case of strep, listening to her gurgle as she'd slept, Jimmy picturing his baby drowning, waiting for the sound of a cough so ground in glass he'd have to leap from bed and scoop her up, rush her to the emergency room wearing only boxers and a t-shirt. She'd healed quickly, though, but Annabeth didn't return the monitor to its box in the dining room closet. She'd turn it on at night. Listen to Nadine and Sarah sleep. They weren't sleeping now. Jimmy could hear them through the small speaker, whispering, giggling, and it horrified him to picture them and think of his sins at the same time. I killed a man. The wrong man. It burned in him, that knowledge, that shame. I killed Dave Boyle. It dripped, still burning, down into his belly. It drizzled through him. I murdered an innocent man. Oh, honey, Annabeth said, searching his face. Oh, baby, what's wrong? Is it Katie? Baby, you look like you're dying. She came around the table, a fearsome mix of worry and love in her eyes. She straddled Jimmy and took his face in her hands and made him look in her eyes. Tell me. Tell me what's wrong. Jimmy wanted to hide from her. Her love hurt too much right now. He wanted to dissolve from her warm hands and find some place dark and cave-like where no love or light could reach, and he could curl into a ball and moan his grief and self-hatred into the black. Jimmy, she whispered. She kissed his eyelids. Jimmy, talk to me, please. She pressed the heels of her hands against his temples, and her fingers dug through his hair and against his skull, and she kissed him. Her tongue slid into his mouth and probed him, searching deep for the source of his pain, sucking at it, capable of turning into a scalpel, if necessary, and cutting away his cancers, sucking them back out of him. Tell me. Please, Jimmy, tell me. And he knew, looking into her love, that he had to tell her everything or he'd be lost. He wasn't sure she'd be able to save him, but he was positive that if he didn't open himself to her now, he would definitely die. So he told her. He told her everything. He told her about Just Ray Harris, and he told her about the sadness he'd felt anchored inside of him since he was 11, and he told her that loving Katie had been the sole admirable accomplishment of his otherwise useless existence. That Katie, at 6, that daughter stranger who'd needed and mistrusted him at the same time, was the scariest thing he'd ever faced and the only chore he'd never run from. He told his wife that loving Katie and protecting Katie was the core of him. And when she had been taken, so had he. And so he told her, with the kitchen gone small and tight around them, "I killed Dave. I killed him and buried him in the Mystic, and now I've discovered, as if that crime weren't bad enough, that he was innocent. These are the things I've done, Anna, and I can't undo them. I think I should go to jail. I think I should confess to Dave's murder and go back into jail because I think I belong there. No, honey, I do. I'm not fit for out here. I can't be trusted." His voice sounded like someone else's. It sounded so far from the one he usually heard leaving his lips that he wondered if Annabeth saw a stranger before her. A carbon Jimmy. A Jimmy vanishing into the ether. Her face was dry and composed, though, so still she could have been posing for a painting. Chin tilted up, eyes clear and unreadable. Jimmy could hear the girls on the monitor again, whispering, the sound like a soft rustle of wind. Annabeth reached down and began unbuttoning his shirt, and Jimmy watched her deft fingers, his body numb. He opened the shirt and pushed it halfway off his shoulders, and then she placed her cheek to it, her ear over the center of his chest. He said, "I just..." "Shh," she whispered. "I want to hear your heart." Her hands slid along his ribcage and then up his back, and she pressed the side of her head tighter against his chest. She closed her eyes, and a tiny smile curled up her lips. They sat that way for a while. The whispering on the monitor had changed to the hushed mumble of his daughter sleeping. When she pulled away, Jimmy could still feel her cheek on his chest like a permanent mark. She climbed off him and sat on the floor in front of him and looked into his face. She tilted her head toward the baby monitor, and for a moment they listened to their daughter's sleep. "You know what I told them when I put them to bed tonight?" Jimmy shook his head. Annabeth said, "I told them they had to be extra special nice to you for a while because, as much as we loved Katie, you loved her even more. You loved her so much because you'd created her and held her when she was tiny, and sometimes your love for her was so big that your heart filled like a balloon and felt like it was going to pop from loving her." "Jesus," Jimmy said. "I told them that their daddy loved them that much too. That he had 4 hearts, and they were all balloons, and they were all filled up and aching. And your love meant we'd never have to worry." And Nadine said, "Never?" "Please." Jimmy felt like he was crushed under blocks of granite. "Stop." She shook her head once, holding him in her calm eyes. "I told Nadine, that's right. Never. Because Daddy is a king, not a prince. And kings know what must be done. Even if it's hard to make things right. Daddy is a king, and he will do, Anna, he will do whatever he has to do for those he loves. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone. Great men try to make things right. And that's all that matters. That's what great love is. That's why Daddy is a great man." Jimmy felt blinded. He said, No. Celeste called, Annabeth said, her words like darts now. Don't. She wanted to know where you were. She told me how she'd mentioned her own suspicions about Dave to you. Jimmy wiped his eyes with the back of his hand, watched his wife as if he'd never seen her before. She told me that, Jimmy, and I thought, what kind of wife says those things about her husband? How fucking gutless do you have to be to tell those kind of tales out of school? And why would she tell you? Huh, Jim? Why would she run to you? Jimmy had an idea. He'd always had an idea about Celeste and the way she looked at him sometimes, but he didn't say anything. Annabeth smiled as if she could see the answer in his face. I could have called you on your cell. I could have. Once she told me what you knew and I remembered seeing you leave with Val, I could guess what you were doing, Jimmy. I'm not stupid. She was never that. But I didn't call you. I didn't stop it. Jimmy's voice cracked around the words. Why not? Annabeth cocked her head at him as if the answer should have been obvious. She stood, looking down at him with that curious glare, and she kicked off her shoes. She unzipped her jeans and pulled them down her thighs, bent at the waist and pushed them to her ankles. She stepped out of them as she removed her shirt and bra. She pulled Jimmy out of his chair. She pressed him to her body, and she kissed his damp cheekbones. They, she said, are weak. Who's they? Everyone, she said. Everyone but us. She pushed Jimmy's shirt off his shoulders, and Jimmy could see her face down at the Penn Channel the first night they'd ever gone out. She'd asked him if crime was in his blood, and Jimmy had convinced her that it wasn't, because he'd thought that was the answer she was looking for. Only now, 12 and a half years later, did he understand that all she'd wanted from him was the truth. Whatever his answer had been, she would have adapted to it. She would have supported it. She would have built their lives accordingly. We are not weak, she said, and Jimmy felt the desire take hold in him as if it had been building since birth. If he could have eaten her alive without causing her pain, he would have devoured her organs, sank his teeth into her throat. We will never be weak. She sat on the kitchen table, her legs dangling off the side. Jimmy looked at his wife as he stepped out of his pants, aware that this was temporary, that he was merely blocking the pain of Dave's murder, ducking from it into his wife's strength and flesh. But that would do for tonight. Maybe not tomorrow or in the days to come, but definitely for tonight it would provide. And wasn't that how all recovery started? With small steps? Annabeth placed her hands on his hips, her nails digging into the flesh near his spine. When we're done, Jim? Yeah. Jimmy felt drunk with her. Make sure you kiss the girls goodnight. Epilogue. Jimmy Flats. Sunday. Chapter 28. We'll save you a place. Jimmy woke up Sunday morning to the distant sound of drums. Not the rat-a-tat and cymbal clash of some nose-ring band in a sweaty club, but the deep, steady tom-tom thump of a war party encamped just on the outskirts of the neighborhood. Then he heard the bleat of brass horns, sudden and off-key. Once again, it was a distant sound, riding the morning air from a distance of 10 or 12 blocks away, and it died almost as soon as it had started. In the silence that followed, he lay there, listening to the crisp quiet of a late Sunday morning. A bright one, too, judging by the hard yellow glow on the other side of the closed shades. He heard the cluck and coo of pigeons on his ledge and the dry bark of a dog down the street. A car door snapped open and shut, and he waited for the gun of its engine, but it never came. And then he heard that deep tom-tom thumping again, steadier, more confident. He looked over at the clock on the nightstand. 11 a.m. The last time he'd slept this late, he'd been... He couldn't remember the last time he'd slept this late, actually. Years. A decade, maybe. He remembered the last few days' exhaustion. The sensation he'd had that Katie's coffin rose and fell like an elevator car through his body. And then... Just Ray Harris and Dave Boyle had come to visit as he'd sat drunk on the living room couch last night, a gun in his hand, watching them wave to him from the back seat of the car that had smelled of apples, and the back of Katie's head stretched up between them as they drove off down Gannon Street, Katie never looking back, and just Ray and Dave waving like mad, grinning like fools, as Jimmy felt the gun itch against his palm. He'd smelled the oil and thought of putting the barrel in his mouth. The wake had been a nightmare, Celeste showing up when it was packed at 8 in the evening and attacking Jimmy, hitting him with her fists, calling him a murderer. "You have her body," she'd screamed. "What do I have? Where is he, Jimmy? Where?" Bruce Reed and his sons pulled her off him and carted her out of there, but Celeste still screamed, full throttle, "Murderer! He's a murderer! He killed my husband! Murderer!" Murderer. Then there'd been the funeral and the service at the gravesite, Jimmy standing there as they lowered his baby into the hole and hit the coffin with piles of dirt and loose rock. And Katie faded away from him under all that soil, as if she'd never lived. The weight of all that had found his bones last night and sunk in deep, Katie's coffin rising and falling, so that by the time he'd put the gun back in the drawer and flopped into bed, he'd felt immobilized, as if his bone marrow had filled with his dead, and the blood was clotting. "Oh, God," he'd thought, "I have never been so tired. So tired, so sad, so useless and alone. I'm exhausted from my mistakes and my rage and my bitter, bitter sadness. Wiped out from my sins. Oh, God, leave me alone and let me die so I won't do wrong and I won't be tired and I won't carry the burdens of my nature and my loves anymore. Loose me of all that, because I'm too tired to do it on my own." Annabeth had tried to understand this guilt, this horror at himself, but she couldn't, because she hadn't pulled the trigger. And now he'd slept until 11. 12 hours straight, and a dead sleep, too, because he'd never heard Annabeth awake. He'd read somewhere that a hallmark of deep depression was a consistent weariness, a compulsive need to sleep. But as he sat up in bed and listened to the thump of drums, joined now by the blasts of those brass horns, almost in tune, too, he felt refreshed. He felt 20. He felt wide, wide awake, as if he'd never need sleep again. The parade, he realized. The drums and horns came from the band, prepping to march down Buckingham Avenue at noon. He got up and went to the window and pulled up the shade. The reason that car hadn't started out front was because they'd blocked off Buckingham Avenue from the flats straight up to Rome Basin. 36 blocks. He looked through the window and down onto the avenue. It was a clean stripe of blue-gray asphalt under the bright sun, as clean as Jimmy could remember seeing it. Blue sawhorses blocked access at every cross street and stretched end to end along the curbs as far as Jimmy could see in either direction. Folks had just begun to come out of their homes and stake out their places on the sidewalk. Jimmy watched them set down their coolers and radios and picnic baskets, and he waved to Dan and Maureen Gooden as they unfolded their lawn chairs in front of Hennessy's laundromat. When they waved back, he felt touched by the concern he saw in their faces. Maureen cupped her hands around her mouth and called to him. Jimmy opened the window and leaned into the screen, got a whiff of the morning sun, bright air, and what remained of the spring's dust clinging to the screen. "What's that, Maureen?"
"I said, how you doing, hon?" Maureen called. "You okay?"
"Yeah," Jimmy said, and it surprised him to realize that, in fact, he did feel okay. He still carried Katie in him like a second stricken and angry heart that would never, he was certain, stop beating its mad beat. He had no illusions about that. The grief was a constant now, more a part of him than a limb. But somehow, during his long sleep, he'd gained an elemental acceptance of it. There it was, part of him, and he could deal with it on those terms. And so, under the circumstances, he felt far better than he would have expected.
"I'm all right," he called to Maureen and Dan. "Considering, you know."
Maureen nodded, and Dan asked, "You need anything, Jim?"
"We mean anything," Maureen said.
And Jimmy felt a proud and everlasting surge of love for them and this whole place as he said,
"No, I'm good. But thanks. Very much. It means a lot."
"You coming down?"
Maureen called.
"I think so, yeah," Jimmy said, not knowing for sure until the words left his mouth. "We'll see you down there in a bit."
"We'll save you a place," Dan said. They waved, and Jimmy waved back and then left the window, chest still filled with that overwhelming mixture of pride and love. These were his people, and this was his neighborhood, his home. They'd save a place for him. They would. Jimmy from the flats. That's what the big boys had called him in the old days, before he'd shipped out to Deer Island. They'd take him to the social clubs on Prince Street in the North End and say, "Hey, Carlo, this is a friend of mine I was telling you about. Jimmy. Jimmy from the flats." And Carlo or Gino or one of the O's would widen his eyes and go, "No shit. Jimmy Flats. Nice to meet you, Jimmy. I admired your work a long time now." The jokes about his age would follow. "What, you crack your first safe with your diaper pin?" But Jimmy could feel the respect, if not a kind of minor awe, these hard guys felt in his presence. He was Jimmy Flats. Ran his first crew at 17. 17, you believe that shit? A serious guy, not to be fucked with. A man who kept his mouth shut and knew how the game was played and knew how to show respect. A man who made money for his friends. He was Jimmy Flats back then, and he was Jimmy Flats right now. And those people beginning to gather along the parade route, they loved him. They worried about him and shouldered a modicum of his grief as best as they could. And for their love, what did he give them in return? He had to wonder. What, really, did he give them? The closest thing this neighborhood had to a governing presence in the years since the feds and RICO had busted up Louis Jello's gang had been, what, Bobby O'Donnell? Bobby O'Donnell and Roman Fallow, pair of bantamweight drug dealers who'd moved into the Protection and Shylock rackets. Jimmy had heard the rumors, how they'd forged some kind of deal with the Vietnamese gangs up in Rome Basin to keep the gooks from muscling in, carved up the territory, and then celebrated the alliance by burning Connie's flower shop to the ground as a warning to anyone who refused to pay their insurance premiums. That's not how you did it. You kept your business out of your neighborhood. You didn't make the neighborhood your business. You kept your people clean and safe, and they, in gratitude, watched your back and became your ears to whispers of trouble. And if occasionally their gratitude came in the form of an envelope here, a cake, or a car there, then that was their choice and your reward for keeping them safe. That's how you ran a neighborhood, benevolently, with one eye on their interests and one eye on your own. You didn't let the Bobby O'Donnells and the slant-eyed Tong wannabes think they could just stroll the fuck in here and take whatever they desired, not if they wanted to stroll back out on their God-given limbs. Jimmy left the bedroom and found the apartment empty. The door at the end of the hall was open, and he could hear Annabeth's voice from the apartment upstairs. Could hear his daughter's small feet scampering across the floorboards as they chased Val's cat. He let himself into the bathroom and turned on the shower, stepped in when it got warm, and raised his face to the spray. The only reason O'Donnell and Farrow had never bothered Jimmy's store was because they knew he was tight with the savages. And like anyone with a brain, O'Donnell was afraid of them. And if he and Roman feared the savages, then that meant that by association, they feared Jimmy. They feared him. Jimmy from the flats, because on his own, Lord knows he certainly had the brains. And with the savages watching his back, he could have all the muscle and balls to the wall, batshit fearlessness he'd ever need. Put Jimmy Marcus and the Savage Brothers together for real? And they could... what? Make the neighborhood as safe as it deserved to be. Run the whole damn city. Own it.
Please don't, Jimmy. Jesus, I want to see my wife. I want to live my life. Jimmy, please don't take that away from me. Look at me.
Jimmy closed his eyes and let the hard, hot water drill his skull.
Look at me.
I'm looking at you, Dave. I'm looking at you. Jimmy saw Dave's pleading face, the spittle on his lips not much different than the spittle on Just Ray Harris's lower lip and chin had been 13 years ago.
Look at me.
I'm looking, Dave. I'm looking. You never should have gotten back out of that car. You know that? You should have stayed gone. You came back here to our home, and there were crucial pieces of you missing. You never fit back in, Dave, because they'd poisoned you, and that poison was just waiting to spill back out.
I didn't kill your daughter, Jimmy. I didn't kill Katie. I didn't.
Maybe you didn't, Dave. I know that now. It's starting to look like you actually had nothing to do with it. Still a small chance the cops got the wrong kids, but I'll admit, all in all, it looks like you may have been guilt-free on the Katie account.
So?
So you killed someone, Dave. You killed someone. Celeste was right about that. Besides, you know how it is with kids that get molested.
No, Jim. Why don't you tell me?
They turn into molesters themselves, sooner or later. The poison's in you, and it has to come out. I was just protecting some future victim from your poison, Dave. Maybe your son. Leave my son out of this.
Fine.
Maybe one of his friends, then. But, Dave, sooner or later, you would have shown your true colors.
That's how you live with it?
Once you got in that car, Dave, you should never have come back. That's how I live with it. You didn't belong.
Don't you get it? That's all a neighborhood is. A place where people who belong together live. All others need not fucking apply.
Dave's voice fell through the water and drummed into Jimmy's skull.
I live in you now, Jimmy. You can't shut me off.
Yes, Dave, I can. And Jimmy turned the shower off and stepped out of the tub. He dried off and sucked the soft steam up his nostrils. If anything, it left him feeling even more clear-headed. He wiped steam off the small window in the corner and looked down into the alley that ran behind his house. The day was so clear and bright that even the alley looked clean. Christ, what a beautiful day. What a perfect Sunday. What a perfect day for a parade. He would take his daughters and his wife down to the street, and they would hold hands and watch the marchers and the bands and the floats and politicians stream by in the bright sunlight. And they'd eat hot dogs and cotton candy, and he'd buy the girls Buckingham Pride flags and T-shirts. And a healing process would begin amid the cymbals and drumbeats and horns and cheers. It would take hold of them, he was sure, as they stood on the sidewalk and celebrated the founding of their neighborhood. And when Katie's death pressed in on them again during the evening hours and their bodies sagged a bit with the weight of her, they would at least have the afternoon's entertainment to balance their grief a little bit. It would be the start of healing. They would all realize that, at least for a few hours this afternoon, they'd known pleasure, if not joy. He left the window and splashed warm water on his face, then covered his cheeks and throat with shaving cream, and it occurred to him, as he began to shave, that he was evil. No big thing, really, no earth-shattering clang of bells erupting in his heart. Just that. An occurrence, a momentary realization that fell like gently grasping fingers through his chest. So I am, then. He looked in the mirror, his face still speckled with drops of water, and felt very little of anything at all. He loved his daughters, and he loved his wife, and they loved him. He found certainty in them, complete certainty. Few men, few people had that. He'd killed a man for a crime the man had probably not committed. If that weren't bad enough, he felt very little regret. And in the long ago, he'd killed another man. And he'd weighted both bodies down so that they'd descended to the depths of the mystic. And he'd genuinely liked both men, Ray a bit more than Dave, but he'd liked them both. Still, he'd killed them, on principle, stood on a stone ledge above the river and watched Ray's face turn white and sagging as it sank beneath the waterline, eyes open and lifeless. And in all these years, he hadn't felt much guilt over that, although he'd told himself he did. But what he called guilt was actually a fear of bad karma, of what he'd done being done to him or someone he loved. And Katie's death, he supposed, may have been the fulfillment of that bad karma. The ultimate fulfillment, if you really looked at it. Ray coming back through his wife's womb and killing Katie for no good reason except karma. And Dave? They'd wrapped the chain through the holes in the cinder block, tied it tight around his body, and locked the two ends together. And then they'd struggled to lift his body the 9 inches it needed to clear the boat, and they'd tossed him over, Jimmy having a distinct image of the child Dave, not the adult, sinking to the river floor. Who knew exactly where he'd landed? But he was down there, at the bottom of the Mystic, looking up. Stay there, Dave. Stay there. The truth was, Jimmy had never felt much guilt for anything he'd done. Sure, he'd arranged with a buddy in New York to have the Harrises sent $500 a month over the last 13 years, but that wasn't guilt so much as good business sense. As long as they thought just Ray was alive, they'd never send anyone looking for him. In fact, now that Ray's son was in jail, fuck it, he could stop sending the money. Use it for something good. the neighborhood, he decided. He'd use it to protect his neighborhood. And looking in the mirror, he decided that that's exactly what it was. His. From now on, he owned it. He'd been living a lie for 13 years, pretending to think like a straight citizen, when all around him he saw the waste of blown opportunities. They were going to build a stadium down here? Fine. Let's talk about the workers we represent. No? Oh, okay. Better keep a close eye on your machinery, boys. Hate to have a fire on something like this. He'd have to sit down with Val and Kevin and discuss their future. This town was waiting to be opened up. And Bobby O'Donnell? His future, Jimmy decided, wasn't looking all that bright if he planned on sticking around East Bucky. He finished shaving, looked one more time at his reflection. He was evil? So be it. He could live with it because he had love in his heart and he had certainty. As trade-offs went, it wasn't half bad. He got dressed. He walked through the kitchen, feeling like the man he'd been pretending to be all these years had just gone down the drain in the bathroom. He could hear his daughters shrieking and laughing, probably getting licked to death by Val's cat, and he thought, man, that's a beautiful sound. Out on the street, Sean and Lauren found a space in front of Nate and Nancy's coffee shop. Nora slept in her carriage and they placed it in the shade under the awning. They leaned against the wall and ate their ice cream cones, and Sean looked at his wife and wondered if they'd make it, or if the year-long rift had done too much damage, squandered their love and all the good years they'd had in their marriage before the mess of the final two. Lauren took his hand, though, squeezed it. And he looked down at his daughter and thought she did look a little bit like something to be adored. A small god, perhaps, filling him up. Through the parade streaming in front of them, Sean could see Jimmy and Annabeth Marcus, and their two pretty girls sitting atop the shoulders of Val and Kevin Savage, the girls waving at every float and open convertible that passed by. 216 years ago, Sean knew, they'd built the first prison in the region along the banks of the channel that ultimately bore its name. The first settlers to Buckingham had been the jailers and their families and the wives and children of the men housed in the prison. It had never been an easy truce. When the prisoners were released, they were often too tired or too old to move very far, and Buckingham soon became known as a dumping ground for the dregs. Saloons sprouted up along this avenue and its dirt streets, and the jailers took to the hills, literally, building their homes up in the point so they could once again look down on the people they'd corralled. The 1800s brought a cattle boom, the stockyards springing up where the expressway was now, a freight track running along the edges of Sydney Street and unloading the steers for the long walk up to the center of what was now the parade route. The generations of prisoners and slaughterhouse hands and their offspring pushed the flats all the way down to the freight tracks. The prison closed in the wake of some forgotten reform movement, and the cattle boom ended, and the saloons kept sprouting. The Irish immigrant wave followed the Italian wave in twice the numbers, and the L tracks were built, and they streamed into the city for jobs, but always back here when the day closed. You came back here because you'd built this village. You knew its dangers and its pleasures, and most importantly, nothing that happened here surprised you. There was a logic to the corruption and the bloodbaths and the bar fights and the stickball games and the Saturday morning lovemaking. No one else saw the logic, and that was the point. No one else was welcome here. Lauren leaned back into him, her head beneath his chin, and Sean could feel her doubt, but also her resolve, her need to rebuild her faith in him. She said, "How scared were you when that kid pointed the gun in your face? The truth? Please. Close to losing bladder control."
She craned her head out from underneath his chin and looked at him. Seriously. Yeah, he said.
Did you think of me?
I did, he said. I thought of both of you.
What did you think?
I thought of this, he said. I thought of now.
The parade? Everything?
He nodded. Aw, she said and kissed his neck. You're full of shit, honey, but it's sweet of you to say. I'm not lying, he said. I'm not. She looked down at Nora.
She's got your eyes.
And your nose. She was staring at their baby when she said, I hope this works. Me too. He kissed her. They leaned back against the wall together, a steady stream of people passing by along the sidewalk in front of them. And then Celeste suddenly stood before them. Her skin was pale and her hair was speckled with dandruff, and she kept pulling on her fingers as if trying to pop them from the sockets. She blinked at Sean. She said,
Hey, Trooper Devine.
Sean held out his hand because she looked like she needed contact or she'd float away.
Hi, Celeste. Call me Sean, it's okay.
She shook his hand. Her palm was clammy, her fingers hot, and she let go almost as soon as they'd touched. Sean said,
This is Lauren, my wife.
Hello, Lauren said.
Hi.
For a moment, no one knew what to say. They stood there, stilted and untethered, and then Celeste looked across the street and Sean followed her gaze to Jimmy, standing there with his arm around Annabeth, the two of them shining as bright as the day, surrounded by friends and family. They looked like they'd never lose anything again. Jimmy's eyes swept past Celeste and met Sean's. He nodded in recognition, and Sean nodded back. Celeste said,
He killed my husband.
Sean felt Lauren freeze up against him. I know, he said. I can't prove it yet, but I know.
Will you?
What? Prove it, she said. I'll try, Celeste. I swear to God. Celeste looked out on the avenue and scratched her head with a lazy ferocity, as if digging for lice. I can't seem to put a finger on my mind lately. She laughed. That didn't sound right. But I can't. I just can't. Sean reached out and touched her wrist. She looked at him, her brown eyes wild and aged. She seemed sure he was going to slap her. He said, I can give you the name of a doctor, Celeste. Someone who specializes in those who've lost loved ones to violent crime. She nodded, though his words didn't seem to provide any consolation. Her wrist fell away from his hand, and she tugged at her fingers again. She noticed Lauren watching her, and she looked down at her fingers. She dropped her hands, then raised them again and crossed her arms over her chest and tucked her hands under her elbows as if trying to keep them from flying away. Sean noticed Lauren giving her a small, hesitant smile, one of abject empathy, and he was surprised to see Celeste respond with a tiny smile of her own and an acknowledgement of gratitude in the blink of her eyes. He loved his wife then as deeply as he ever had, and he felt humbled by her ability to convey instant kinship with lost souls. He was sure then that it was he who had wronged their marriage with the emergence of his cop's ego, his gradual contempt for the flaws and frailty of people. He reached out and touched Lauren's cheek, and the gesture caused Celeste to look away. She looked out onto the avenue as a float in the shape of a baseball glove drifted by, ringed on all sides with little leaguers and t-ball teams, the kids beaming and waving and going crazy with the adoration. Something about the float chilled Sean, the way the baseball glove maybe seemed less to be cradling the kids and more on the verge of enveloping them, the kids oblivious, smiling like mad. Except for one.
He was subdued, and he looked at his cleats, and Sean recognized him immediately. Dave's son.
Michael!
Celeste waved to him, but the kid didn't look back. He kept his eyes down, even though she called his name again.
Michael, honey! Sweetie, look! Michael!
The float kept drifting along, and Celeste kept calling, and her son refused to look her way. Sean could see a young Dave in the kid's shoulders and the droop of his chin, his almost delicate good looks.
Michael!
Celeste called. She pulled her fingers again and stepped off the curb. The float passed them, but Celeste kept following it, moving through the crowds, waving, calling her son's name. Sean felt Lauren idly caress his arm, and he looked across the street at Jimmy. If it took him the rest of his life, he was going to bring him down. You see me, Jimmy? Come on, look over again. And Jimmy's head swiveled. He smiled at Sean. Sean raised his hand, the index finger pointing out, the thumb cocked like the hammer of a gun, and then he dropped the thumb and fired. Jimmy's smile broadened. Who was that woman? Lauren said. Sean watched Celeste as she trotted along the line of parade watchers, growing smaller as the float continued up the avenue, her coat flapping behind her. Somebody who lost her husband, Sean said. And he thought of Dave Boyle, and he wished he'd bought him that beer like he'd promised on the second day of the investigation. He wished he'd been nicer to him when they were kids, and that Dave's father hadn't left him, and his mother hadn't been nuts, and that so many bad things hadn't happened to him. Standing along the parade route with his wife and child, he wished a lot of things for Dave Boyle. But peace, mostly. More than anything, he hoped Dave, wherever he was, got a little of that. This concludes the reading of Mystic River by Dennis Lehane. This book was read by Scott Brick. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.